This is a message from sponsor Intuit TurboTax. Taxes was getting frustrated by your forms. Now Taxes is uploading your forms with a snap, and a TurboTax expert will do your taxes for you. One who's backed by the latest tech, which cross-checks millions of data points for absolute accuracy, all of which makes it easy for you to get the most money back guaranteed. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
Is your business ready for growth? At Krogan Colonial Bank, we recognize the ambition of business owners like you. Our commercial lending services can provide the flexible financing necessary to expand your operations, invest in new opportunities, or manage your cash flow effectively. Don't put your business ambitions on the back burner. Turn to Krogan Colonial Bank to help you move your business forward. Krogan Colonial Bank. Helping good people make good decisions. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. All loans subject to credit approval.
Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC. Transformation that works. With the tech to stay ahead and the know-how to act. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
This is News Talk.
Now, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Emmett Oliver, and this is a show that looks at business and politics on a wider perspective. And coming up on the show today, with all the talk of Russia and Ukraine easing towards a peace deal, we look at the issue of sanctions and what actual effect they've had on Russia. What is the best day of the month to get paid? And would you be better at getting your salary every week? We'll put the theory to the test. Plus the streaming wars, who's winning and who's losing. You can, of course, email the show at takingstock@newstalk.com. Is there really a best time to get paid? You could go weekly, you could go monthly, or you could even go daily, although it's been a long few centuries probably since anyone was paid in that manner. But there is week 53, a phenomenon where there's an extra day in the year. Could it mean extra cash for you? Or is that just a myth? So the whole area of take-home pay, there's a lot of mythology around this area. But should we be asking a more central question like, have you got the right tax credits and pension entitlements lined up after making it through the first 2 months of the year? Some of these questions are slightly pressing. Now, I'm joined by Garoid O'Sullivan, who's a chartered accountant. He's with Chartered Accountants Ireland, and he's their tax lead. You're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much, Evan.
Before we get started, just what exactly is week 53? Before people get too excited about it.
Yeah, so I suppose to say straight away, there's nothing to get too excited about there. That's a concession that there was a concession previously, and now there is legislation allowing for tax credits to be slightly expanded on the occasion of a 53rd week in the year. So that can occur where we'd say there is say if. You just have basically an infrequent payroll. Every about 5 or 6 years it can occur, right? And they just allow the tax credits to be expanded by 1/52. So it's a very small amount. But I suppose the issue came up because I suppose people were wondering about optimal pay frequencies. And I suppose to say here, there isn't really any tax planning opportunities we're talking about when we talk about, I suppose, the frequency of pay. Look, most of us are paid on, a lot of us are paid on a monthly basis, and we've an annual salary that's agreed. And I suppose the question that people would want to know, is there any benefit really to me to be paid on a more frequent basis? And look, for most of us, I think monthly pay works well. If you think about it, I suppose really what we're looking about is a budgeting sort of scenario, and how can I best budget for the different costs that can arise?
Sure. Well, listen, we'll come on to the budgeting in a second, but just to finish off on this week 53 thing, because I know a lot of people, rightly or wrongly, got very excited when they first came across the concept. So most employers are saying you're paid €50,000 a year. Let's take that as a figure notionally. You know, we're going to pay you for 12 months worth of work. Is that right? Is that what most companies are doing?
That's a typical arrangement. And I suppose from an administrative perspective, that's the most straightforward way for a business to work. Because if you think of it, every single time I issue a payroll, there's a cost to that. So if I'm issuing more than one payroll a month, obviously that's a substantial addition, administrative burden and an administrative cost for a business. So going monthly, I suppose, is the most efficient method. And, you know, revenue systems work well. They spread your credits across the 12 months. And this is why, you'll have an equalized level of take-home pay throughout the year. So I suppose monthly is sort of the standard. And for most of us, it's, I suppose, the most straightforward way to plan our affairs as well.
So if there is an extra day in a particular year, should you not be getting the benefit of that? Are the companies getting a free day's worth of extra work out of you?
I suppose, I think it's slightly overstated in the sense that your annual salary is as agreed, you know, and that's, I suppose, you know, often within employment contracts, there would be a reasonable amount of overtime included where you are a salaried worker. So let's say at certain times of the year, you know, many employers might give you an extra hour here and there because you might have other commitments, and there's sort of agreed working arrangements that way. So I think salary is sort of the agreement in terms of what your year's work is worth. Now, in terms of is there an extra day, I wouldn't, I suppose, fall into that way of thinking.
You're making me sound very guilty for even thinking these things.
Yeah, no, I would. I suppose, let's see, if you're a person who works on an hourly basis, and if there is an extra day a year, you will be paid for that, those extra hours you work. So if there's extra time in the year, well, then you'd be obviously, you know, remunerated for those extra hours you work, because you will be based on hourly. It's an hourly contract, we'd say. Now, if you are based on an annual salary, I suppose the advantage of that is you've got certainty throughout the year, and each month as to what you're taking home. So I suppose that's the advantage of having an agreed annual salary. And okay, maybe there is 1 year every four where there's an extra day in the year, but I suppose, you know, overall the average works out as to be fair, I would say.
Now, most of us, although not everybody, is paid on that monthly basis, and the month is a long time. I mean, January just seems to drag on and on. I just don't understand dry January people. That's the last time to be dry as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, in terms of what's happening, you've got a long few months, obviously February is shorter and so on. Would it be better for all of us and stress levels and efficiency in the economy to just pay us on a fortnightly, weekly? And what would the financial implications be of that for the employee?
So from the employee, the financial implications are just you're getting paid more regularly in terms of your tax credits will still be spread out over the different pay frequency. I suppose the advantage of being paid monthly is if you take some of the big outgoings we have each month would be your rent or your mortgage payments, you know, your utility bills, or any other commitments you might have. And I think there's a lot of advantages to having that lump sum come in at the same day every month, so you can arrange things like your direct debits and your other commitments around the same time, so in conjunction with that. Now, look, the point about slightly longer months and obviously at Christmas people get an early payday, that is something I think that again has its advantages and has also the swing of having a long period where you're waiting for that paycheck. But again, that's just down to effective budgeting, I suppose, on each of our individual parts.
Yeah, you can feel the whole country sort of cracking up by January the 31st or the 30th. It just, as you say, it's so long since the last installment went into anyone's bank account. It makes everyone sort of chew their fingers a little bit, doesn't it?
It does to an extent, but look, on the bright side, I suppose, when those, I suppose, that week or two of Christmas is there, it is nice just to have a bit of comfort to know, right, I have a bit of extra cash, I can plan ahead, I'm not going to go into the red at Christmas, and obviously that's important as well, but certainly I think the January time is one that you have to always be careful that, you know, am I managing my spending appropriately over those weeks just to make sure I have enough at the other end. And again, look, it's something, if that was an issue, I suppose, with early payday for enough people, well, then I suppose you'd be talking about maybe there could be some discussion at company level where people decide, look, maybe we'll get paid a little later. But I think, again, look, there are many advantages to that early payday at Christmas. So I suppose it just is, January will always be the long month. Now, there are other examples, obviously, with February being a slightly shorter month, and then you might have July where you might have an extra 3 or 4 days working or days to work in the month. But again, you're talking about a daily additional budget there. And I guess really what you're looking at is the fact that, you know, your big commitments will still be going out at the same time every month. And I think once you can manage those effectively, that's probably the most important thing for us all to be managing on a budget.
Yeah, and a company, I could see companies saying, I wouldn't mind actually putting everyone on a quarterly payroll, just having to do it 4 times a year would be a massive saving and efficiency, but obviously employees wouldn't be too keen on that. But American companies, of course, report on a quarterly basis.
Yeah, well, there could be other issues there for the company, because then you have a massive cash flow coming out every quarter, and it's probably easier for a company to manage it on a monthly. So that's why I think the monthly is that nice happy ground where I suppose we're all on that cycle, as I say, because those big commitments operate in the monthly cycle, And companies can, as I say, manage their own cash flow effectively over the year. That monthly really is, I suppose.
Instead of all of us sitting around, and put myself in that group as well, sitting around worried about week 53, you don't have a whole lot of good news for us there. Is there things of more substance we should be looking at? Take-home pay, tax credits, all of this stuff. I mean, we hear all the time that people can be set up incorrectly. They aren't necessarily maximising, as a company would do, how much tax they pay. I mean, where are we on all that? How do you see, most of us, I suppose, are on PAYE. Maybe there's less you can do there, but are we actually maximising our take-home earnings rather than sitting around and worrying about week 53 issues?
Yeah, and that's the key point. There are some really important things that the listeners can be doing to actually reducing their tax bill. So the one, Revenue have put out a number there that is about 400 million euro in unclaimed tax credits. They reckon that's about the amount in the ether at the moment that's there to be claimed. So one of the big ones at the moment that they're encouraging people to claim is the rent tax credit. So this is a tax credit of up to 1,000 euro for people who pay rent. So there are certain conditions attached to that. But I suppose fundamentally, if you're entitled to claim this, it's a very easy credit to claim. You can go on to Revenue's My Account facility, put on your login details, and you can manage all your tax from this portal. It's a relative...
And Garoid, what do you put down the lack of claiming on it? Is it just the burden of administration, or people don't know about it, or why do you think people aren't getting there and getting their hands on that money?
It's a good question. I suppose a bit of an information gap, that could be part of it. But I just think because we're payroll workers, we're not, I suppose, in the mode of managing our tax. We wouldn't necessarily think, I'm going to log on to Revenue. There's also, I think, generally a bit of hesitation when it comes to engaging with Revenue. I think that's just something that can be...
Nah.
Well,
your friendly local Revenue inspector, you know, cuddly.
Yeah. Exactly. So there's probably a portion of that as well. But Revenue have designed the system very effectively to give them their due. So what I'd encourage anyone who hasn't done it is to just log on to your My Account and have a look. Because again, you can look back at the last 4 years of tax, and in many cases, people could be even due an overpayment of tax. So, you know, sometimes the payroll system doesn't always apply the tax absolutely correctly. And we saw this during COVID, where people might have been entitled to 100, 150 euro of an overpayment, but it just wasn't.
And I would say everyone, virtually everybody who starts a new job is probably on the wrong tax rate initially. A lot of them pay emergency levels straight off the bat. So that then has to be repaid back through, you know, they're just not set up in the system correctly. So that must be a massive amount of money, I would have thought.
And that does get equalised. So often with the emergency pay, that would get that will often get rectified in the next payroll once your tax credits are sorted. But another thing people mightn't claim, let's say, is health expenses. So you can do that in real time as well. So let's say I've hurt my leg and I have to go to the physiotherapist, and you know, none of these services are cheap. But let's say I incur a 200 euro charge for my physiotherapy fees. Well, you can go onto my account during the year, you can upload the expense, and you can get your credits in real time as well.
Now, as we know, Garoid, a lot of people are in what you might call standard issue PAYE jobs, but a lot of people are in work for multinational companies where getting shares is a part of their compensation. It might be even up to 25% of their take-home pay is coming through shares, what we call share-based incentive schemes. I mean, how do you view all of that? Are people doing the right thing there? Or do they know what they're doing? What kind of stories have you heard in that area?
Yeah, so Revenue, about 2 years ago now, Revenue actually did what's called a level one compliance campaign. And this is just a very soft touch compliance campaign where they give taxpayers the opportunity to rectify or at least examine their tax affairs. So what they noticed was that a lot of employees getting these share options were not aware of their actual personal tax filing obligations. So as a result, they wrote to people who are potentially in receipt of these share options, these unapproved share options, and said, look, if you have exercised share options and there's a gain on them, you actually have to pay the tax. Now, what that led to is new rules whereby now if I exercise a share option, that gain is actually now taxed through payroll. But the thing you still need to keep in mind is that if you sell those shares subsequently, there may be a capital gain, and that's still with the employee to manage.
So if I'm working in a big US company here in Ireland, I go online and I say, I'm only picking this name at random, but here's my Intel shares. I've got 20,000 euros worth. There they go. you're saying that nothing is taken at source, nothing, you must do all of that yourself.
So what happens with a share option is you're given the option to purchase the share, and typically you can pay for that option, and it'll be typically a modest amount. But then when there would be a value set on that share at the time the option is granted.
They vest, isn't that the word?
Exactly. And once the shares vest, then you get the option to exercise those shares. And on exercise, there's going to be a difference from the exercise price. And
that's your gain, yeah.
And that's the gain, right? Now, that is now operated through payroll for POE workers. But if you hold on to that share, so you exercise the share, now I own, not a share option, but I own a physical share. Well, now I own an asset. And if I subsequently sell that asset and I make a gain from the exercise price to the sale, well, then there's a capital gain there. And that's when it comes back on the employee where you have personal tax filing obligations.
So that will never go through your company's payroll. That part you'll have to declare yourself. Is that the case?
Exactly. The capital gain subsequent to exercise will then be with the employee. Now, there's a whole other host of share option schemes and different share-based remuneration schemes, but generally the share options or the restricted share units, these kind of things will be common. But it's always, I suppose, when you get share options, the key thing, I suppose, the key message I'd like listeners to take is just to be aware, do I have personal tax filing obligations there? Just because I'm an employee doesn't mean I might not have some personal tax filing obligations to consider.
Yeah, it's funny that they don't just get put it through the company. At least then it'll be all captured from even from a revenue point of view. They'll all be sort of visible and so on.
Yeah, well, I think that was the great change now that they now operate the share option gain through the company, because I think that's the piece where typically with these share options, the company would manage the whole process. And I think employees would just have seen an amount of money gone into their bank accounts and thought, well, surely now the tax is settled because my company does all this for me. So yes, that shift has happened. But as I say, when you hold a physical asset, then it's back onto you. So you may have personal tax filing obligations. Now, often what happens is when people exercise the share options and they receive the shares from the company, typically a lot of employees will sell the shares at that date again. And typically there wouldn't be, it's unlikely that a gain would arise at that moment, because the share option gain that you pay tax on, becomes part of your what they call the base cost for capital gains. So
okay, listen, Geroid, thank you for walking us through that. I'm afraid getting the week 53 bad news was like a splash of cold water into the face, but nevertheless, it was good to just pursue, because there has, as you said, been a fair bit of excitement. But I think your general advice is just make sure you don't have a gain that's there that hasn't been reported and accounted for to revenue. For the moment, we leave it there. Geroid O'Sullivan, who is from the Chartered Accountants of Ireland, he's their tax lead. Thank you for joining us on Taking Stock.
Thanks very much.
Next up, who's winning the streaming wars?
Is your business ready for growth? At Krogan Colonial Bank, we recognize the ambition of business owners like you. Our commercial lending services can provide the flexible financing necessary to expand your operations, invest in new opportunities, or manage your cash flow effectively. Don't put your business ambitions on the back burner. Turn to Krogan Colonial Bank to help you move your business forward. Krogan Colonial Bank, helping good people make good decisions. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. All loans subject to credit approval.
For a limited time, you can get KFC chicken with the sweet heat of hot honey. And after one bite, you'll wonder, how do bees make hot honey so hot? Are they special bees? Does KFC have dragon bees? Fire-breathing dragon bees that create spicy honey? No, silly. There's no such thing. KFC just partnered with Mike's Hot Honey to drizzle all over their crispy chicken. But dragon bees would be so cool. Try it now for only $7 or share a box with friends for $25. Prices and participation vary while supplies last. Taxes, tips, and fees extra.
Now, Netflix, Amazon Plus, Paramount Plus. Any of these names mean anything to you? Of course, the first one or two do, but after that, yeah, it gets a bit hazy. Like any war, the streaming wars has many fronts, from the chase for awards to the cost to us, the viewer. To make some sense of what's at stake for the streamers and how it might impact the price you pay, I'm delighted to be joined by News Talk's own Cecil B. DeMille, John Vardy, who's here with me now. John, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thank you, Emmett.
John, we all have one of these in our houses.
Yes,
some of us have two or three.
Yeah.
Some of us are now completely confused by what's on when and where, unlike old terrestrial television, which was all very predictable. So we know streaming viewership is now representative of almost 43% of all total TV watching time. But are all these companies really equal in size?
That statistic you gave is from The Gauge, which is a global monitor of it, and 43% sounds bizarre. But when I look at my kids' viewing habits, it makes a lot of sense. They watch YouTube videos, they watch TikTok videos. If they're going to watch a TV show, what they do is put on Disney or Netflix. So the concept of live TV for our children's generation seems to be, I don't want to say dead, but moribund, let's say. Live TV is not coming to an end, but it is certainly in crisis, and the streamers are there and thereabouts. And so that's a long way of saying to you, are they up to the market? The global economics would say so, yes.
And it gets confusing because Netflix, as you say, is a streamer, so they're not a terrestrial television.
No.
But now they're suddenly doing live events like boxing and so on and the NFL, right?
Yes.
So it's getting fuzzier, isn't it?
It is. And you see, the thing about it is Netflix, in terms of available market, right? Netflix are this huge behemoth. I forget how you say that word.
I think both are okay.
Yes, okay. I think everyone will know what I mean. But they only have 6% of the possible market when you look at globally. So they still have miles to go and billions to make. So yes, live TV is the thing they're getting into. Watching award show, sporting events, even stuff like Chris Rock, the comedian, had his last special live on Netflix. Now you wonder about the efficacy of that and how much that's actually going to bring in, but that's certainly the direction that they're heading in. But from an economic point of view, the direction that they're really heading in, and it hasn't come to hit here, but it has in other territories, is two very important things: advertising and password sharing. That's where they're attempting to make the money. So in Ireland, you pay $14.99, I think, is the top cost of it. If you don't want to pay that in the States, you can pay $5, but there will be ads.
Now, it reminds me a little bit of the early sort of frontier days of search engines. Google eventually came true, and nobody really remembers the other names at this stage. There was Alta Vista, I remember them. But here, this is kind of like a frontier industry. Okay, we've been there for a good few years now, but Netflix is the big name we all know. But there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
So normally when that happens, it gets very congested in any market. There's winners and losers, and there's a shakeout.
Yeah.
Do you see Netflix as kind of separate from the others, the chasing pack, or how do you see it all evolving?
Yeah, well, there are two possible things. The lesser known entities like the Paramount Pluses of the world and the HBO Maxes in America and stuff like that.
Apple TV?
Would you put them separately? I think I would, because we'll get into them in a second. They're a more interesting case. But what's either going to happen is people like Paramount and even Disney will get a larger wedge of the streaming chunk of change, and terrestrial TV and networks will continue to fall away or really fight for the pitch, or some of these late arrivals won't go anywhere and they will wind up. You also have Peacock in the States. So it's really, really interesting times. But one thing we can be sure about in all of this, however it's harming terrestrial TV, it's certainly harming cinema going, and that's irrefutable. Now, that may be another day's work.
Yeah, well, this was, I look at the buttons, you've got streaming, cinema, and then you've got the players. You've obviously got BBC player, RT player, and the rest of it. So are they a separate group again, or how do you break up this market?
That's a good point. And the RT player, the Virgin Media player, the BBC player, they're going to become much bigger things, because my children's generation are not, as I say, used to watching live events. So it will be the case that if in 10 years' time there's a great BBC show, they're inculcated in streaming now in a way that you and I weren't. If we wanted to watch the Only Fools and Horses Christmas special, we had to sit there on Stephen's Day at the agreed time.
And then wait until the man at the BBC presses the button.
Our kids don't understand that. So if RTE, BBC, CNBC want to continue to be a force, their player services are going to have to become
now, the one area they can't do anything about is the live event, right? So a football match only starts at a certain time. But they are, what Netflix responded to that, which we discussed a few minutes ago, is like, well, let's have some live events, right? Yeah. So they're looking at what terrestrial television still has. And could you have a Six Nations or something on a Netflix in future years?
Yeah, I'm sure they could. And let's not forget, these people have a lot of money. But they are going after sports that haven't traditionally been tapped. They're making a big play for wrestling, which to us might seem, really, is that the smartest move? But it's a much bigger thing.
They effectively create a new sport, don't world there. Yeah, for the viewing.
To an extent. I mean, wrestling has obviously is popular in America as it is, but this would be bringing it in a different direction.
Now, as a professional film critic, right, which is how you earn
well,
your...
I'm sure there's one around.
Yeah, professional film critic, as opposed to the amateurs, right? But you look at Netflix and you look at their back catalogue, and when they first started, they were sort of like, here's all these old movies, yeah. and they're sitting there and you can download them. Then they've started making their own stuff, yeah. right? Producing their own... content. It's reasonably recent since they've been doing that.
Yeah.
So as a professional film critic, do you go on there and go, the stuff they do is a very high quality and as good as any of the studios have ever done? Or do you kind of still go, yeah, when it comes to the big blockbusters, they're still not quite there? Where do you place them in terms of, you know, movie making and making content?
Yeah, well, and certainly in TV, they have been revolutionary, Netflix, because you see, people forget Netflix started as a mail order DVD rental. That's how it started. And really it began, they got Breaking Bad and suddenly they realized, wow, people are tuning into this.
They're binging, to use the phrase.
And they started investing in their own content. And we had, you know, the list is endless at this stage. House of Cards, Bridgerton, all these things. The Crown, for instance, the production values on The Crown are irrefutable. I mean, they are huge. And there is great TV shows on Netflix and indeed on Disney and indeed Apple TV. But some of it is dross. From a movie making point of view, they are still learning how to make movies. And unfortunately, on Apple TV and Netflix and Disney, a movie made specifically for the streamers can often have a sense of this is a streaming movie. Now, there are some exceptions like The Irishman and Roma that they poured a lot of money into, but I don't think they've quite cracked.
But they do seem to be able to persuade big actors to do them, right? And I was amazed during COVID when Tom Hanks appeared on Apple TV with that submarine movie, which I cannot remember the name of. So, I mean, they're getting A-listers. It's not as if like, oh, well, they can't get the big names. They've kind of middle. So am I right in that perception?
I you know, I promised I wouldn't name drop, but I was interviewing Robert De Niro too.
Or Bob, as you call him.
And this is the first time he's done a TV show, Zero Day. So if you can get De Niro onto TV, and he did the Irishman movie for Netflix. So there is no longer a divide in actors' minds between TV and movie making, it has to be said. Now, the Disney thing is very interesting because Disney, although after Netflix, have a huge amount of legacy stock that makes them the second place or after Netflix. Because once Disney Plus came online, they had all the Star Wars movies, they had all the Disney movies from over the years, Snow White, Moana, they owned Fox, so they had The Simpsons, Family Guy. So Disney, I have to say, is great bang for its buck. I mean, there's a lot of dispute. How can you afford all these, you know, streamers? No one could pay these every week. But I think, you know, Netflix probably is first mover advantage, but after that, Disney is the next best.
Okay, well,
in terms
let's talk,
of what's up there.
Let's talk about this money you mentioned, right, and what it costs. So I'm going to be, my job is to be a bit skeptical, right?
Yeah.
So just bear with me on this. So if you take your average family, you know, okay, so they're going to have to pay the license fee if they have a television recording apparatus.
Yeah.
So out goes that money, right? The second thing, a lot of people who like sport will have a Sky Sports subscription
or
whatever,
a
Sky package, right? So then on top of those two, if you want to see certain series that you've mentioned already, you'll have to have a Netflix streaming subscription. Now, you might say, that's lots of choice, Emma. Choice is good. We like choice. But are they not disadvantaged as opposed to the 20-year-old where we all were from, where, you know, yes, okay, it was limited and there was issues when it was on and all the rest, but you paid your license fee for your trestle television. You got some movies, you got some sport, you got the news, the end. Now you're actually having to pay more just in terms of the outflow from the family's sort of the household budget.
Absolutely.
Am I totally wrong in that?
No, you're completely right. And it would seem that there are too many streamers, certainly on an Irish example, for enough people to play. Because Netflix, you know, the packages are different, but most people are probably playing around 15 quid. If you wanted Apple TV, you're looking at about $8.99 a month. Disney is $10.99 a month. Most households can't afford to have more than one, at best, two of these. Paramount, one of the new arrivals, still don't think their content is up to scratch.
Amazon Prime
we haven't even mentioned. There's plenty of dross on there, but there's also plenty of good stuff in there. It's technically called Prime Video now, and that I suppose has advantage, as in Amazon and Prime. Amazon, though, is just a behemoth, again, if I may use that. And they're in every avenue of our life. But the idea that you would have three or four of these, I don't think is suitable. But what's, just to bring it back to the economics, because this is a business show.
Indeed.
After all. But Netflix in 2022 were in serious trouble. Their share price was way down and they mounted this big correction, as they called it, or the great correction.
The password crackdown.
Yeah. But also advertising. And it has severely helped.
I got an email the other day telling me about a price update,
yeah,
which when you decoded it was a price increase. I love the word update rather than increase, right? Very clever.
Price update.
So Netflix, obviously, as you say, they've been putting through these price increases. That was part of the plan, I suppose, yeah, you know, and they're monetizing it, to use that ugly word,
yes,
at this stage. I mean, their long-term future, you're seeing pretty confident streaming is here to stay.
Yes.
There's going to be a shakeout, if I'm correctly...
Yeah.
Is there enough content there? I mean, a lot of people talked to me during COVID about, oh, crikey, I've absolutely, you know, I've excavated everything out of Netflix. It's there's nothing there anymore. So they've obviously built out this catalogue. It's a much more powerful beast than it was 4 or 5 years ago. So where's the threat? If you're a CEO of Netflix, is there any clouds on the horizon, or is it just grow, and that's
it?
Well,
it would seem to be that that's the way it is. The biggest threat is probably what you pointed out, terrestrial TV doing more with their players. But people like Apple and Disney, I think, are going to have to make huge leaps to overtake them in any way. And Netflix have huge plans. And, you know, Netflix is the only one of these streamers that has its own verb. People say, I'm going to go home, Netflix and chill. No one else has that. So their first mover advantage is still quite an advantage, you would have to say.
Now, one final one, just to talk more parochially.
Yes.
Sorry, listeners, about this, but we have to be have to be this way inclined. A lot of people will look at Netflix and say, a lot of Irish people are subscribers. I don't have the exact Irish figures. They're obviously packed into the global ones. But people will say, they're coming in here. They're now starting to take advertising. They're taking subscription revenue. Well, yeah, they're not putting a whole lot back in. It's not as if, I know they have some Irish movies, so I can't accuse them of doing nothing. But people who are into Irish culture will say, what are they putting into the Irish arts, or what are they putting into Irish movie making? So what would you say to that argument?
Well, I would say, you know, what are Sky Sports doing for all these people? I mean, it's the economics of entertainment. Leonard Cohen says we can't get upset about that because commerce and entertainment always melded. I don't think Netflix have a responsibility to keep Irish actors and TV writers in business. That's not really their modus operandi.
John has just fallen out with every source and interview he knows.
No, not at all.
And but I understand the reality is,
absolutely.
It's global.
Yeah, and look, ultimately, Netflix are making more TV shows that Irish actors can be in and have been in many things. One of the biggest success of Colin Farrell's career has been The Penguin. You know, more TV is being made as a result of these streamer services. Says, look, the world always needs stories. I think they're just changing the way they're being told. So I don't think it's a good or bad thing.
Very briefly, because we're out of time, I think, cinema, we just very briefly, if you're the head of a big cinema company, I know they've had financial disasters, or Jeff COVID was a particular problem for them, obviously. Is there any good news for this in them at all, or is it pretty bad?
It's not great. And what's happening with cinema is, and this is another day's discussion, is event cinema is doing well. So the new, like for instance, this year we're getting ready for the Minecraft movie or the Barbie Oppenheimer thing. The independent movies are definitively suffering and sometimes going straight to streamers. So I don't want to end on a downer, but cinema has seen better days. But let's not forget, I always say this, Hollywood exists in a permanent state of crisis. When it first started, there was a fear about changing from silent movies to acting. Color. In the 70s, they thought directors had too much money. Videotapes were meant to kill it. Hollywood lives in crisis. It will going to be fine. People will still be going to the cinema.
So they're durable. They've survived this long.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay, listen, streaming wars, we're paying too much, but we can't deny it and we can't stop looking at it. So thank you very much for that conversation. Who's John Fardy, of course, who is a regular film critic here at the Station, you'll know. Thank you very much for joining
us on
Taking Stock. Next up, we go sanctions.
Is your business ready for growth? At Krogan Colonial Bank, we recognize the ambition of business owners like you. Our commercial lending services can provide the flexible financing necessary to expand your operations, invest in new opportunities, or manage your cash flow effectively. Don't put your business ambitions on the back burner. Turn to Krogan Colonial Bank to help you move your business forward. Krogan Colonial Bank, helping good people make good decisions. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. All loans subject to credit approval.
Busting. I'm Emmett Oliver. Now, as we know, we are stumbling, we're told, towards some kind of a peace deal between Ukraine and Russia, although the exact contours of that are yet to be fleshed out. But how successful in all of this was economic sanctions imposed by the West on the Putin regime? We were told at the start, of course, this would bring Russia to its knees, but is that actually what has transpired? I'm now delighted to be joined by Ed Conway, who's economics and data editor at Sky News, who's been looking into this and has come up with some surprising findings from his research. Ed, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Hi, Emma. How are you doing?
Now, as we know, let's just go back to sort of February 2022. The war starts in Ukraine, and there was a lot of very, I suppose, giddy and excitable talk that Russia could be really crippled by a package of economic sanctions. There was talk about taking them from the SWIFT system in terms of banking and finance and payments. There was also talk about hitting gas and oil revenues. At a more broad level, how has it all worked out? Is that the way it has played out?
Yeah, I mean, we were told that these were the kind of most far-reaching sanctions that had ever been imposed. And it was, you know, it was Europe, it was the UK, it was America. And the idea, I guess, was that we weren't going to go to physical war with Russia, but we were going to impose economic war on Russia and that we kind of starved them out. And there were a number of different types of sanctions. So you've got sanctions on the assets that are held by Russia overseas. So those were confiscated, financial assets. You've got sanctions on individuals. You've got sanctions on exports from Russia. And that mostly means things like kind of oil and coal and gas. And then you've got sanctions on stuff that's going into Russia. And what we were told at the time was put that all together and the Russian economy is going to be on its knees within a matter of months. But what in the end has happened is certainly the Russian economy is not doing very well at the moment. It's got very high inflation. It's not in a great place. But it's been nowhere near what we were kind of sold. And I think part of the explanation for that is that when you look at how sanctions have actually been imposed, they've been incredibly leaky. And actually, they've been imposed with much less conviction than you might have thought if you were listening to all the politicians a long time ago. So, for instance, Europe is still importing enormous amounts of gas from Russia. It's still importing enormous amounts of fertilizer from Russia, and not to mention things like kind of aluminium and other metals. And we may not be importing directly Russian oil, but what's happened in practice is it used to be that Russian oil would go out of Russia and then it would end up in a refinery, you know, in the UK or somewhere else. And then it would kind of come to us in the form of kerosene. What's happened instead is those tankers just leave Russia. Instead of going to Europe, they go to India, turn it into kerosene, load it onto another tanker, send that kerosene over to Europe. And we use that kerosene in our planes. We use diesel from Russia in our cars. And so nothing fundamentally has changed. I mean, you know.
And is this a problem of third countries, those link countries in the middle that allow Russia to still exist? Is that the key problem, or are they just badly designed, these sanctions, in the first place?
Well, that's the interesting thing. What you're seeing here is this just the limits of the kind of globalized world? So when people talk about third countries, it's like, is it just going via another country? And definitely, you could say that's happening with Russian oil. So it comes out of Russia, it goes to India. I guess you call that a third country in this case. It gets refined or laundered, some people might say, and then turned into a product that gets used in the countries which say they're sanctioning Russia. Nothing's really fundamentally changed. And then if you're talking about stuff that we send to Russia, we are still sending it to Russia. So I've been through all of the kind of trade records, and there's many different items which are now sanctioned from going into Russia. It's component parts that go into weapons. It's components that go into drones. It's radar parts. It's stuff that you can turn into weaponry and that we know has been found on the battlefield in Ukraine. We're not supposed to be sending that into Russia, and we're not. But what we are doing, and I say we, this is Europe as a whole.
Yes, the West.
You know, the West. But what is happening is it's not going to Russia, but it is going to somewhere like Kyrgyzstan or Kazakhstan or Azerbaijan. And then once it is in these countries, which are neighboring former Soviet countries, which are neighboring Russia, then it kind of just disappears from the register. And you're in that kind of gray area. We know it shows up in Russia. We suspect it has been smuggled over the border. But in practice, you know, it's just, it is a kind of a big grey area that allows Russia to carry on getting the stuff it needs, including from Europe. So we're part of this.
And Ed, the other issue, I know you're mainly, your research has been on goods, but one of the big sort of threats to Russia was to be cut off from the international payment system. Have you seen anything in that area that has hurt them? I mean, obviously they have their own currency and so on, but I mean, have you found that that was something that, because this was really talked up in a major way coming into the start of the war.
It was, wasn't it? SWIFT. It was the payment system that the West uses. Russia wasn't going to be part of that. It's not altogether clear. I mean, I'm not an enormous expert, but it's not altogether clear that that has had the cataclysmic impact that people thought it would. Russia has been able to, it has to some extent just got closer to China using different payment systems, and to some extent just been able to use other assets to transact. There's no doubt that when you put all of this stuff together, that it has increased the amount of friction that it takes to get stuff around. But we've also got to remember, you know, that the cultural and economic memory in Russia of getting stuff unofficially through the border, you know, that's, it was quite recently that, you know, a lot of these businesses were kind of in the Cold War mindset. And a lot of those kind of workarounds about how to get something, whether it's money or something physical around these sanctions or barriers, it's just been reactivated. And so we're kind of back to the Cold War all over again.
I'd like to put another theory to you, which is that it may have actually consolidated the Putin regime in this sense, that a lot of the Western companies left, their businesses were then effectively sequestered by the Russian state. And then Putin was able to kind of dole out all these companies and assets and interests to Russian business people or oligarchs and so on. So that kind of didn't work out in the sense that the businesses still existed. So McDonald's went or Coca-Cola or whoever went, but their factories and their stores and so on were still in place. And he just took them over and doled them out to others. Would that be a fair characterization?
Yeah, exactly. With some of the kind of brands that were there, they got kind of slightly rebranded, and you're still able to get something that looks and tastes a little bit like a Big Mac in Moscow. And for the luxuries, I mean, the whole point of this was supposed to be that we're going to starve you of the luxuries that you've come to depend on, so you're not going to be able to get all of these nice things. But in practice, either A, there have been workarounds like that, or B, as I say, there's no statistical evidence that things like luxury cars made in Stuttgart or indeed in the UK, there's no statistical evidence that this stuff goes into Russia. But I went out to the border of Russia and Georgia and literally watched as this convoy of Porsches and Range Rovers and Lamborghinis and Mercedes and all of these cars just went over the border. And this is happening on an industrial scale. It is happening, but no one really wants to talk about it. And the problem with this story, I guess, is that it's a bit depressing, isn't it? Because we're all part, I guess, of the problem here. Europe hasn't really been able to impose these sanctions, or hasn't been willing to impose these sanctions, partly because it involves enormous economic sacrifice. And if we didn't want to get, you know, to send our stuff to Russia, if we didn't want to take Russian gas, then life would be even more uncomfortable and painful for us than it already is. And I think that...
I accept that. And is it also a function of the fact that Russia is so sufficient in energy? So in other words, if you were going to take an exhibit for a country that could survive this, I mean, I'm just thinking of places like Ireland or the UK and so on, where we import so much. Russia was kind of a tough nut to crack because it has such energy reserves, such a large geographical place, and obviously it's got a very command structure economy. So it wasn't an easy place to implement sanctions onto. It was always going to be a bit fuzzy. Would you accept that at all?
I think that's right. And I think we forgot in Europe just how central energy is to everything. And we've certainly had a big, you know, it's been a big wake-up call on that front, because we've all seen our bills go up, and it's been really painful, as you say, particularly for Ireland, UK, places that import or most of our energy from overseas. And so I don't think Russia ever forgot that energy matters. Energy is in everything. You can't make anything without energy. When you're eating something that has probably been fertilized by chemicals that are made from natural gas. You're eating something that, you know, it takes diesel to get to you. All of these things are areas where Russia has this big advantage. It's not a very sophisticated economy, but it is very energy intensive. And here in Europe, we are dependent on that. We have hitched ourselves, and particularly Germany, but it's frankly all of us to some extent. We've hitched ourselves onto that energy dependence on imported gas. And right now, I don't think people have much appetite for truly cutting ourselves off from that, which is why still, even now, there are tankers taking Russian gas, Russian liquefied natural gas, down through the Irish Sea a lot of the time, sometimes, you know, down the North Sea, into Europe. It's happening right now. And a lot of the gas that's being burned in Europe is Russian gas, even now, even kind of, you know, 3 years on. And people find that kind of shocking, but that's because the sanctions don't actually cover some of the stuff that is most important to us, because we couldn't quite cope without that.
Yeah, we couldn't substitute, presumably, in the time. You know, a lot of people didn't see the Ukraine war coming. Exactly. Some people did, but, you know, there wasn't a chance to substitute very quickly. How are you going to suddenly replace all these fossil fuels? As you mentioned in your recent book, it's not an easy thing to transition into over a year. Obviously, there's a lot of US LNG coming in as well. So has the a lot of the Russian stuff been replaced by American stuff, or how has that all played out?
Sadly not. I mean, if you look across Europe as a whole, part of the issue here, okay, is that we, in the UK, you know, we have the North Sea, but it's a really declining basin, as they would call it. It's somewhat declined in the Netherlands. They've got some gas, but that's going down as well. So basically what's happened is the amount of gas that we're able to get out of the North Sea and in the Netherlands, that's gone down. That's been just about balanced out by the extra gas that's come in from America. But the Russian gas hasn't been replaced. You know, you've got this massive gaping hole, and that Russian gas hasn't been replaced. What's happened instead is the industry has shut down. And so because the energy prices are so high, we're not making fertilizer in the UK anymore, for instance. We used to make fertilizer. We don't anymore. We're not making key chemicals here anymore. We're shutting down plants. In Germany, they're not making, you know, many of the things they used to make before. We're deindustrializing. And so that's been the real fundamental economic consequence of this, is Europe has deindustrialized at the most rapid rate in history because its entire economic model depended on cheap Russian gas. And a lot of that gas has gone. Like I say, we're still reliant on Russia for some of the gas, but a lot of the gas has gone. And the stuff that's coming in is more expensive because there's not enough LNG coming in from elsewhere now, to make it.
Sure. Good. To try and at least put the case for the defense of the politicians who put all this together. Obviously, Joe Biden has left the stage and Donald Trump's in now. But they might say to you, well, unless we go for a full scale, you know, kind of military embargo where you're blocking Russian ports and you're putting ships across shipping lanes to stop them, which we're not apparently prepared to do for obvious escalation reasons, there's only so much you can do. What would you say to that argument?
No, I mean, it's true. You've got to be pragmatic about this. And the reality is either it would involve an extraordinary amount of extra sacrifice, and it doesn't seem like Europe is quite willing to do that. But if you're not willing to do that, then it's a bit disingenuous to make the scale of promises that we've been making. And I think that's the gap. The gap is between the rhetoric that you and I have heard a lot about from politicians and then the reality on the ground. And the reality on the ground is a bit depressingly incongruous with that rhetoric. And like I say, I find the story, I'm a journalist and I've been covering this for the last kind of year and a bit. And what I'm surprised about is that we're not going on about it more, but then by the same token, I can kind of understand why not, because it's not like a happy story. We're all implicated in this. There's no straightforward.
So, for argument's sake, but maybe I'm just, you know, sort of blue sky thinking to use that cliche. But we come to the summer. There's some kind of agreement or a ceasefire agreed between the two sides. How much of that will be down to sanctions? In other words, presumably it's not a zero. It has had some effect on Russia and some effect on the thinking of the Putin regime. But would you kind of characterize it as pretty moderate? Or I know that's a difficult question, but how would you weigh up what has been done in the overall kind of calculations of this conflict?
Yeah, well, I'm slightly guessing at this, but I would guess that the aid and weapons we've given to Ukraine has been far more significant, and the bravery of Ukrainians has been far more significant in terms of, you know, resisting some of the momentum that Russia had to try and move across the country, which in turn is what kind of determines what the contours are of any peace deal. I mean, like you were saying at the start, we don't quite know what's going to happen. But I think sanctions haven't been the enormous impact that they thought, that people thought, you know, said they were going to be. And right now, if you listen to policymakers, they'll suddenly say, oh, well, actually, what we really wanted was to just to make it a bit more expensive for Russians to get the stuff they needed. I mean, that's nonsense. Back in the back at the start, they were saying this was going to cripple the Russian
economy. Yeah, I think that's the point, isn't it? The claims were big. They were pretty garish at the time. They haven't come true. But listen, keep your reporting going. I don't see why it's not a valid Thank story. You. Certainly for me, it is anyway. So listen, thank you for the moment. Ed Conway, who is economics and data editor at Sky News. Thank you for joining us on Taking Stock.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of Taking Stock. This has been Emmett Oliver. I'm glad to have your company along. Just to remind you, the show is available as a podcast first on Friday morning on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning, of course, at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy. And on research this week were Stephen Daunt. We also had Hugo De Silva on sound. Thank you for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Is your business ready for growth? At Krogan Colonial Bank, we recognize the ambition of business owners like you. Our commercial lending services can provide the flexible financing necessary to expand your operations, invest in new opportunities, or manage your cash flow effectively. Don't put your business ambitions on the back burner. Turn to Krogan Colonial Bank to help you move your business forward. Krogan Colonial Bank, helping good people make good decisions. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender, all loans subject to credit approval.